of Israel's security apparatus while demonstrating that Palestinians are fed up with Israeli violations of their basic human rights. First, let's get a wrap-up of what has occurred in the past days. Mona Kandil is our correspondent, joining us from occupied Ramallah. Well, lots to have happened, unfortunately, to have led to some deaths here. Give us the overview of the incidents, Mona, if you can.
Well, we have to mention why, in the first place, Israeli forces raided the Jenin refugee camp today. The Israeli military stormed the refugee camp of Jenin in order to arrest the father of Raad Hazel, this Palestinian who carried out a shooting operation in Tel Aviv on Thursday, and he was killed by the Israelis Saturday morning. Of course, this operation led to the killing of three Israelis, and he wounded nine others. The Israeli forces raided Jenin in order to arrest the father of Raad Hazel and his brothers. They surrounded Hazel's home, and the Israeli intelligence phoned his father and ordered him in order to hand his sons and himself to the Israeli forces, but he refused. He said, if you want me, you come and take me. I will not surrender. This operation, the clashes took place between Palestinians and Jenin refugee camp and Israeli forces. This led to the killing of one Palestinian, Ahmed Saadi. The Jihad movement said he was one of the members of the armed wing of the Jihad movement, Saraya al-Quds, and 13 others were wounded, according to Palestinian paramedics. However, the Israeli military said the operation in Jenin didn't end. They will storm Jenin refugee camp again and again. However, the Israeli cabinet decided to impose new sanctions on Jenin. First, the closure of Ajnami checkpoints between Jenin and the lands occupied in 1948. Palestinians living in the lands in 1948 are not allowed to enter Jenin. Anyone from Jenin who have relatives.
Quickly, if you can, because we want to get to the guests. Mona, we understand that Israel has given its security forces carte blanche, that they can do whatever they want in a matter of speaking. I want to find out from you if that's true, because many have said that that gives them the right, in their eyes, for executions if they wanted to, which was cited in one of the deaths.
Of course, this is right, because the operation that was that had taken place in Tel Aviv was really painful for the Israelis, and they didn't expect it. So they gave a green light for the forces to do whatever necessary.
Thank you for that. Our correspondent there, Mona Kandil from occupied Ramallah. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Palestinian scientist and author Mazen Kumsaya joins us from Bethlehem. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, joins us from occupied Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Mazen Kumsaya, let me first start with you. We're looking at, obviously, an increase in the number of deaths. I can give you a wrap-up of that, but I'm sure that you have a sense of what has happened here, particularly the one that happened in busy Tel Aviv street. Tell us your assessment of what is going on here, and, of course, how it is that you're having resistance fighters be able to carry out an operation right in the streets of Tel Aviv.
Well, this is a natural response to Israeli continued violations of human rights of Palestinians, ethnic cleansing that's happening in Jerusalem, denying of thousands and thousands of Palestinians access to the holy city, authorizing settlers to go into the Al-Aqsa Mosque area even during the holy month of Ramadan. And I could go on and on, but there is endless provocations and oppressions from the State of Israel on the Palestinians. So one expects what's called lone wolf attacks, because also the Palestinian Authority works to suppress organized resistance. And when you have peaceful resistance becoming very difficult or impossible, that means that people resort to violence. So Palestinians, some individual Palestinians, take it upon themselves to resist. And this young man who killed three Israelis in Dusseldorf Street in Tel Aviv is one such person.
All right, Saad Nim, so obviously there's some, it's a state of people being frightened in Israel. Looking at the statements from the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, it's quite telling, who says, "We suffered a defeat and the perpetrator escaped the scene easily." So that shows how security failed. Then the security of settlers has been damaged. This situation will continue for a while. And then finally saying that this has created fear among Israelis who now dread walking the streets. So pretty big impact, this operation, resistance operation that took place in Tel Aviv, don't you think?
Yes, indeed. It's quite obvious that not only by the war minister and the chief of staff, but also the Hebrew media generally today and yesterday, it was all over the issue. And they were talking about this huge failure, not only of what happened on Thursday night, but also the last, 10 days, if you like, with the many operations that's going on in Beni Brak, near to Tel Aviv, in Lechdera, and in also in other areas around in inside the Zionist entity. So what's going on in reality that Israel cannot stop this kind of operations, and they admit that this is something for them is really puzzling, because we are talking about individuals who are, doing that from their own side, and there is no any indication, in spite of the coordination with the Palestinian Authority, they cannot even expect and predict these kind of operations. And that's why they have this kind of fear about, the failure of the security system in Israel in such a way that anyone could come in, and it's for the first time that they installed roadblocks inside Israel itself on the roads leading to Tel Aviv and other areas. Now the Israeli, not only us, they have to stop at the roadblocks, which means that they are really in a state of fear, in a state of insecurity, and they feel that they can't, do these things like before. Usually the Israeli are so proud of their security system, and it's like, one of a kind, but apparently these last few days have proven without any doubt that the Israeli security system is not that kind of superior kind of security system, but it has its own flaws as well. And these kind of operations, they couldn't even stop. And we expect that they will see even more in the coming few days of such operations.
Mazen Kumsaya, we have to talk about the reactions coming through on this. And the one that stands out is first how the U.S. and the EU ambassadors to Israel, as well as the EU and UN Middle East peace envoys, they've all come out condemning the attack. And even when you look on online social media, it's an uproar that you see based on people saying, "Oh my God, people in Tel Aviv, Israelis were killed in Tel Aviv." And yet when you have Palestinians being killed, you don't hear anything condemning Israeli security forces for what they have done. Doesn't that spell double standard in the way that this topic is approached?
Indeed, there is some challenge to the public relations aspect of the Palestinian Authority and what it's trying to do is trying to stay viable in the sense that it's dependent on the largesse of the Western donors, Europeans primarily, and also trying to satisfy Israel, which is a de facto sovereign entity over the West Bank and Gaza. So the Palestinian Authority tries to bridge a gap, so to speak, and try to be balanced and diplomatic and satisfy the needs from the Western world. Of course, that makes them problematic in the eyes of the Palestinian public. And most of the Palestinian public actually recognizes that such activities, including armed resistance and nonviolent resistance, are natural response to colonization and occupation. So standing against the public in this matter is not helpful to the Palestinian Authority, and it's not helpful to, I mean, your guest mentioned security failure. I would say there's also a diplomatic failure and a political failure of the State of Israel at containing the Palestinians and containing the Palestinian Authority. Eventually, Palestinian Authority will fold out of its own weight.
Well, of course, we're looking at Saad Nimr, how Palestinians are being violated almost on a daily basis, if not on a daily basis. Hamas has come out and said the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes attempts to Judaize East Al-Quds and to perform sacrifices at the Al-Aqsa Mosque to build its so-called temple. And he goes on to say more things, but basically citing that as reasons. But these reasons have been there. Why has there been such an increase in the past weeks leading up to Ramadan and then now over to we're a week into it?
Oh, yes, definitely. The sensitivity of Ramadan. And usually the Palestinians during Ramadan, they would usually go to Jerusalem and they will stay there overnight in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The prayers and Taraweeh and the rituals, which is, you know, bring them closer to their religion. So it's usually a yearly event. But this year, it was so clear of the incursions done by the settlers against the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and especially this guy Ben Gvir, as well as the government, who are allowing the settlers to have their incursions during Ramadan, and their statement that we are going to enlarge the scale of the incursions to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. And that was a kind of a challenge to the Palestinians more than anything else. Plus, in the last, you know, let me say, last few months, there was a huge escalation by the settlers all over the West Bank against the Palestinians, whether it's, you know, by land grabbing and building settlements, enlarging existing settlements, confiscating more and more land, and especially in the Jordan Valley, in addition to the settlers who became really, really very violent against the Palestinians, standing on the streets and stoning the Palestinian cars, injuring Palestinians. And the Israeli army is just, you know, watching them. So there was a kind of an encouragement by this Israeli government to these settlers to do whatever they want, including the incursions on Jerusalem, in Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. That is very sensitive issue, especially in Ramadan for the Palestinians. And everyone was expecting something happening. And I would remember that more than 10 days or 15 days, we were talking about that, and we were saying that we are expecting more violence coming in the few days to come in Ramadan because of the Israeli measures. Israel is should take the full responsibility of the Palestinian reaction because they did not even stop or even try to stop. Instead, they have this meeting in Negev Desert with some Arab foreign ministers trying to influence Jordan and the Palestinian Authority to calm down during. Okay, the Palestinians are saying officially, we want to calm down. How about you? What about the Israelis? They didn't calm down at all. And they were, you know, encouraging the settlers, who said that we are going to increase our entrance to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. So they were, you know, aggravating the Palestinians.
Well, you talk about this meeting that were held with the foreign ministers of the Negev Desert. So I have to ask you, Mazen Gumsaya, your reaction to that. I mean, this normalization that has taken place is what's transpiring, and action is taking on that front instead of moving towards what was one day called a so-called peace talks between Palestinians and Israelis, the name that was under Trump, which he obviously did not live up to that, nor have any other previous U.S. presidents. When you talked about the diplomatic front there, Mazen Humsaya, what do you think about this meeting that took place at the Negev Desert?
Well, this is not normalization. It's a collusion and a collaboration that has been going on for decades under the table. It's just the only difference that happened in the Trump era was that the U.S. Pushed publicly those Arab regimes to do it above the table and show their faces, basically. So that's the only difference is cosmetic. I mean, it's psychologically important that you have these Arab leaders meeting publicly. And in the stolen Negev, as we know, the Negev subjected to a campaign of ethnic cleansing. Some villages and towns there have been destroyed more than once. Al-Araqib was destroyed more than 200 times and rebuilt. And so to happen in the backyard of this catastrophe of the Naqab is itself horrific. But at the same time, I don't think it changes the dynamic. And it's the last gasp of a Zionist regime that's looking to look nice in front of the world. And it's not working, I think.
Okay. Let's take a look at international law when it comes to the way that Palestinians actually have resisted. And I'd like to ask you, Saad Nim, when it comes to international law, based on what it's enshrined, it says Palestinians do have a right to use armed resistance against the Israeli military occupation. But at the same time, Israel characterizes any and all resistance to its military occupation as terrorism. Why does Israel perceive it that way?
This is a real irony, because what's going on, that the victim, which in this case we are, we're supposed to protect our occupier. That's our role now, to protect our occupier. As far as the international law is concerned, Palestinians do have the right to resist the occupation, and there was in 1982 a resolution saying specifically for the Palestinians that they have the right to use any mean of resisting the occupation, regardless, including the armed struggle, any mean that they find it appropriate. So I think that the conduct of the Palestinian Authority on the international level, though they are trying to make all their petal now regarding the international community and in the UN and all the other organizations. But I think the discourse that they are using is not the one that they should use. It's very weak, and it's just, you know, like being, look what's going in Ukraine with Russia. You are condemning there. You are supporting them there. You are not. This is not the way. We can't hold our people anymore. That's what they should say. We can't stop Hamas. We can't stop Jihad Islami. We can't stop anyone if you continue with your measures against the Palestinians. If you continue with these settlements and the settler activities, we can't hold our Palestinian people from doing all this. That should be, you know, the discourse of the Palestinians, what to talk about. We can't do that because, you know, we are playing the weak part. And even apparently we like that, or the Palestinian Authority, they like this kind of role, and they continue to play this kind of weak character in front of the international community, which is absolutely not acceptable by the Palestinian people. And that's why the Palestinian people on their own now, in the last 2 days, ways, the encouragement by the Palestinian people in all cities, in the West Bank particularly, were huge to the operation. They were, you know, giving sweets in the streets, and they were like demonstrating in support. This today at Bir Zeit, our university, we had a huge rally by all the students, all together, all the factions, to stand with Jenin and what happened in Jenin this morning. So the people level is totally different from the Palestinian Authority level, who are talking to the international community.
All right. Yeah. Well, you talk about the words of encouragement. You also have, Mazen Kamsaya, what Hamas has said, another part of the statements that came out of Hamas, stating the continuing terrorism of the occupation and its crimes, attempts to Judea's Jerusalem, along with the fact that you have military aggressions against our people in Jenin should generate a massive intifada uprising against the Zionist occupiers. Given what we have seen transpire, this resistance operation in Tel Aviv, do you think that there's a possibility that this may lead to a third intifada were it to continue?
This is for
Masin Kamsaya.
It's very hard to predict the future, of course, but we've had 14 uprisings. They come and go in waves. Every 10 years or so, we have an uprising on average. And it's a growth of the resistance in a way that becomes massive and involve large segments of society. We saw this in last May in the events that happened on both sides of the Green Line in the West Bank and Gaza, inside the Galilee and the Naqab and around the world with people rising up against the Zionist regime. I think eventually there will be an uprising. I can't predict exactly what will happen, but in terms of low scale resistance, you would expect such things to continue and increase, especially during the holy month of Ramadan, when the assault on Islam and Muslims in the Middle East increased from the Zionist regime, and when the collaborationist regimes of United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Morocco, and even Saudi Arabia are doing what they are doing. People have to react. It's a law of physics. To every action, there's a reaction. So I think that's natural.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Thank you, though, for that. That's Masin Kamsaya from Bethlehem, Palestinian scientist and author. And thank you, Saad Nimr from occupied Ramallah, professor of political science at Bir Zeit University. And we had our correspondent, Monica Ndil, at the top of the spotlight. We come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitavoy and the entire team. It's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Surah Al-Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَمْ تَحْسَبُ أَنَّ أَكْثَرَهُمْ يَسْمَعُونَ أَوْ يَعْقِلُونَ إِنْ هُمْ إِلَّا كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا
Or do you think that most of them hear or reason? They are not except like livestock. Rather, they are even more astray in their way.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the 44th verse of the chapter. أَمْ تَحْسَبُ أَنَّ أَكْثَرَهُمْ يَسْمَعُونَ أَوْ يَعْقِلُونَ إِنْهُمْ إِلَّا كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا Do you think that most of them do hear or understand? They're nothing but like cattle. Nay, they are further astray from the path. Dear listeners, this verse is criticizing pagans more. The Holy Quran uses the word akthar to differentiate between those who will be guided from others afterwards. أَمْ تَحْسَبُ أَنَّ أَكْثَرَهُمْ يَسْمَعُونَ Do you think that most of them do hear or understand? And then it continues saying, إِنْهُمْ إِلَّا كَالْأَنْعَامِ They're nothing but like the cattle. An animal has got no intellect to know goodness. An animal does not understand badness, falsehood, truth. But deviated men act according to their low desires and do not follow their reasons and intellects. Although they are bestowed by the Almighty Allah, this intellect. To show the importance of this matter, and somehow emphasizing on the previous verse, which said, أَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَهَهُ هَوَى Have you seen the one who has taken his low desires as his gods? This verse says, إِنْهُمْ إِلَّا كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا They are nothing but like the cattle, but they are further astray from the path.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi
a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The concept of this verse is also mentioned in different verses in the Holy Quran, which are about the hell dwellers who have got such a fate because of not using their eyes, their ears and intellects. It is said elsewhere, these are as the cattle, rather they are more astray. أُولَٰئِكَ كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ. So, it is in short clear that they have gone astray, but commentators have said interesting matters about this subject. Some say that the reason that the beasts cannot know anything, the reason they do not have a heedful ear and clear-sighted eye, is that they do not have such abilities. But man is more miserable than them, for he has been bestowed the essence of all talents. Allah has offered him so much talent that he can even be his vicegerent on the earth. But he will reach a state that he will be reduced to the level of beast, and even lower. He has wasted all his merits. He is reduced from the rank of being prostrated by the angels down to the abject rank of evils. This is really painful. This is really, this can be called clear misleading from the path. Even the beast somehow will not be reckoned. They will not be divinely punished. But the misled people must take the burden of their deeds on their shoulders. They will be punished. They will see the chastisement of the Almighty Allah without any reductions. Beasts sometimes provide men with many services. They do various jobs. But disobedient people provide no service. They cause many disasters and destructions. They are arrogant, they are faithless, and they begin a war in which millions of people are murdered. But these beasts do not pose anyone that kind of threat. And even if they do, it is limited. The interesting point is that the beasts never justify their actions. If they do an action, it is because of their nature. It is a wrong action, but it is natural. But it happens when sometimes that an arrogant, tyrannical, wistful man justifies all his crimes as though he has done nothing, as though he has done his humane and divine duties. And if beasts do not have any program and law, they follow the path that creation has determined for their instincts. They go through this way. But obstinate and disobedient people respect neither the laws of creation nor the divine legislation. They count their wishes, their desires, as the ruler of everything. أَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَهَهُ هَوَاهُ. So that's why we say, إِنْهُمْ إِلَّا كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ سَبِيلًا. That's why the Holy Quran says, أُولَٰئِكَ كَالْأَنْعَامِ بَلْ هُمْ أَضَلُّ. That is why, in comparison between these two, they are worse than the cattle. No creature is more dangerous and more harmful than a wistful, disobedient man. And because of this, such a man is named the worst of beasts in different chapters of Holy Quran. What a proper name it is. So man, who is the vicegerent of Allah, will sometimes be worse than beasts if he neglects his nature, if he lets his low desires rule him. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode of the program as well. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As voters go to the first round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English-language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least two dozen shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence, keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate.
In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians.
Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
One of the men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Big question I get asked. Now in a series of bombshell revelations being made in a new Netflix series, the handwritten correspondence between 1986 to 2006 shows Prince Charles asking the late Saville for tips in repairing the reputation of the royals. Experts argue that the prince was duped like so many others, but even without the benefit of hindsight, Charles's association with Saville seems surprising.
It's remarkable that they didn't call upon the services of a professional PR company and they sought the services of Jimmy Savile. It just goes to show the lack of judgment and the lack of understanding of the potential for this kind of blowback when they cavort with these celebrities, not knowing anything about their background or not even trying to look into their background before they do so. We are talking about the royal family after all, aren't we?
These new revelations, albeit of a past association, adds to the woes of an institution already struggling with the fallout from the Meghan Markle-Prince Harry union, Prince Andrew reaching a multi-million pound settlement for allegations he had sex with an underage girl, and outstanding accusations that Prince Charles's former associate exchanged financial inducements for helping a Saudi millionaire with his British papers.
This new revelation is something the royal family could well do without. At a time when the House of Windsor is scrambling to repair its image and reputation after a series of very public missteps, the association between one of the most prolific abusers in history and the heir to the throne is a serious blow.
As Queen Elizabeth scales back on her public duties, Prince Charles must now try and convince an uncertain public the crown will be safe in his hands. On this evidence, at least, the jury is out. Amina Taylor, London.
Just days after a UN-backed truce came into force in Yemen, fears have risen over the implementation of the agreement, with key promises regarding commercial flights being allowed to enter Sana'a's international airport failing to materialize so far. At the time of the UN announcement, senior Yemeni officials warned onlookers to remain cautious about raising their hopes prematurely. Despite the warning, many Yemenis have already become excited for an end to the war.
The truce is wonderful for us and the region in general, a great thing, and we hope that the truce will last not only for 2 months, but rather permanently, because the people are tired and they have suffered a lot.
Yemenis have faced their fair share of disappointment over the years in regards to peace efforts. Multiple nationwide ceasefires have all failed, and the 2018 peace talks hosted by Sweden also failed to produce an end to the conflict. However, experts still believe the flights will begin soon.
The truce is holding very well. Reports of violations do not amount to breaking the truce. It's the usual standard violations that take place in similar situations. The Saudis have been trying to get out of this quagmire for a long time. And the big major conference in Riyadh is their way to initiate exit out of the Yemen conflict. So I'm very hopeful that this will lead to some major break in the Yemen conflict.
This truce, which the United Nations is already celebrating, could turn into a curse rather than a blessing for millions of Yemenis if key pledges regarding the siege are not upheld. In particular, so many will be hoping that they can finally get into Yemen to visit their besieged loved ones. If that turns out not to be the case, then it would be another additional heartbreak on top of the many already broken hearts which have been caused by this devastating conflict. Robert Carter, London.
A Turkish court has suspended Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi's trial in absentia of 26 Saudi nationalists accused of murdering the man inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The Turkish justice minister said a red notice had been issued for 26 suspects. 20 of them were asked to be extradited to Turkey. However, the court's request was rejected, and Saudi Arabia demanded the case be transferred to Riyadh.
A red notice was issued for 26 suspects, and 20 of them were asked to be extradited to Turkey, but all our requests were rejected. Saudi Arabia later demanded the transfer of this case. Now the government recommended the court to close the trial in absentia and transfer the case to Saudi Arabia. However, the trial would continue in Saudi Arabia, and Turkey will wait to see convictions and sentences before dropping its own case.
The case will be transferred to Saudi Arabia. However, it is seen by many as if it will be closed. Saudi officials say the case is already closed and those involved were convicted. Khashoggi's fiancée Hatice Cenkiz, however, said she would appeal the decision, speaking to reporters in front of the courthouse.
Turkey is not ruled by a family like in Saudi Arabia. We have a justice system that addresses citizens' grievances. We will appeal the decision in line with our legal system.
Many believe the change in Turkey's stance is due to Ankara's bid to restore its relations with countries in the region.
After 4 years of not reaching its purpose and due to the suspects not being extradited to Turkey, to stand in front of the judge, it seems appropriate for Turkey to transfer the case to Saudi Arabia. However, the timing here serves Turkey for sure. It comes ahead of an expected visit by Turkish president to the kingdom, and as Turkey is restoring its relations with countries in the region such as United Arab Emirates and Israel.
Turkish officials had previously said that Khashoggi, who is a known critic of MBS, was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in an operation approved by highest levels in the kingdom. Khashoggi's trial intensified a friction between Ankara and Riyadh, but it seems President Erdogan is looking for a warm welcome during his upcoming visit to the kingdom. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance.
The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if polls have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The West has declared the collapse of the Russian economy as its goal over its offensive in Ukraine. Moscow, however, says the sharp rise in prices of fuel, grain and other goods, as well as record inflation, hit unfriendly countries almost harder. In the meantime, Russia is reorienting its economy to new markets, and Iran is one of them. Level of trade between Russia and Iran hit a new record in 2021, surpassing the equivalent of $4 billion, with Russian exports to Iran accounting for more than $3 billion of that figure, and Russian imports reaching $967.3 million, up to 21.4% more than a year earlier. During a meeting between business circles of the two countries, businessmen and economic experts discussed readiness from both sides to increase their trade level.
Under heavy Western sanctions, Iran seeks opportunities in boosting foreign trade with Russia. The share of mutual trade between the Russian Federation and Iran is insignificant, but our responsible persons have a serious determination to increase this share. Our goal is to increase trade with Russia to at least $10 billion. This is in the short term.
Meanwhile, entrepreneurs from both countries say they are looking for opportunities to enter the market of the opposite countries.
We are very interested in increasing trade with Iran because the Republic of Dagestan and Iran are close, both by the Caspian Sea and the land route. Prices for Iranian goods are also very attractive for us.
Russia is a very attractive market for us, and we have been trying to enter it for several years. We want to export dairy products, but there are many issues. Banking and customs relations, obtaining permits for Iranian plants, including veterinary ones. There is a lack of professional advice, which slows down work.
As Western countries are increasing their economic pressure on Russia, the country has focused on rapid import substitution and the markets of other countries that have not imposed sanctions on Moscow. Iran has also announced agreements with Russia on the use of national currencies in trade.
Foreign participants know that Russia can use the experience of countries like Iran to foil Western sanctions. They also say boosting economic partnership between Moscow and Iran will help both countries contain Western pressure. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The latest voter polls in France have shown an almost total evaporation of a once sizable lead for President Emmanuel Macron. His edge over 2017's far-right runner-up, Marine Le Pen, is now down to just 3 points in a hypothetical second round, making the race a dead heat. France goes to the ballot box for the first round in just a few days on April 10th. Recent missteps by Macron may have alienated a French electorate which featured a 40% undecided rate just last week. Macron is being openly accused of trying to run from his record by hiding behind the unrest in Ukraine. He has refused to join any debate before the second round vote and has barely campaigned in France. With Macron's refusal, there was no typical first-round debate between the 11 presidential hopefuls. Instead, every candidate sat down for a highly anticipated televised grilling from journalists, all except Macron. His decision has come under harsh scrutiny as being anti-democratic.
It just shows how much Macron is just like all the other politicians, thinking only of himself. He knows that he did not implement the change that he'd promised, and that's why he can't face anyone. I may submit a blank ballot or vote for the riskiest candidate. That may be the only way to change things.
Macron, who did not hold his first press conference until more than 2 years into his term, has long been criticized as displaying a monarchical aloofness and an authoritarian style of governance. The election campaign has been dominated by xenophobia, which then created major disinterest and now worries of record abstention. With the left still running in third place, a candidate with many far-right policies seems certain to take office.
The right wing has been exploded into different sections, and both Macron's section and Le Pen's section are stable. 2017 destroyed the other parties and also the influence of society's intermediaries, such as unions and NGOs. And maybe we'll say later that this was a bad thing, but I'm not really interested in this election until the second round.
The huge recent victory of Le Pen's counterpart in Hungary has many wondering if Poles have similarly underestimated the right nationalist candidate in France. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea test launched a solid fuel space rocket designed to place a satellite into low orbit for surveillance and reconnaissance of North Korea. The test comes just 1 week after North Korea tested a long-range ICBM, prompting a UN Security Council emergency meeting and more sanctions from the United States. Activists in South Korea argue that the behavior of the U.S.-South Korea alliance and its double standards cause tension.
Now they say a lot about the missiles launched by North Korea, but nobody criticizes South Korea and the U.S. firing ICBMs and various other missiles. I think that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is getting worse because of such a hypocritical attitude.
The U.S. last year agreed to allow South Korea to develop missiles of unlimited range. President-elect Yoon Suk-yeol has said he will strengthen the country's alliance with the U.S. and the missiles Seoul deploys, policies garnering significant support.
The ability to quickly receive various military and security information thanks to satellites will strengthen national defense. The stronger our national defense, the more it might provoke North Korea. But I think that the stronger our power, the more it can contribute to peace.
South Korea's president-elect also advocates the preparation of a preemptive missile attack on North Korea if Pyongyang poses an imminent threat. South Korea appears determined to develop space-based military applications in line with its alliance with the United States. South Korea's Air Force chief is scheduled to travel to the U.S. Space and Missile Command next week and discuss South Korea joining a multilateral space alliance led by Washington. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight.
Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading "Drop in Life Expectancy Speaks Volumes About How U.S. Handled COVID," expert says. Here's the details. Just over a month into year three of the COVID-19 pandemic, research revealed recently that life expectancy in the United States declined again in 2021, which followed a well-documented drop in 2020 and contrasted a recovery trend in other high-income countries. The paper, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, shows that U.S. life expectancy fell from 78.86 years in 2019 to 76.99 years in 2020 and 76.60 years in 2021, a net loss of 2.26 years. The study comes as progressives in Congress continue to fight for Medicare for All legislation to replace the U.S. for-profit healthcare system, one in which 112 million adults struggle to afford care, according to Gallup and Wealth Health.